The Tom Woods Show, episode 1009.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
BuzzFeed says, if you've never heard of Ebates before, get ready to make some easy money. You're already shopping online anyway at a variety of merchants. Might as well earn some cash back. Check out Ebates, and if you refer just two people, you get 50 smackers. Check it out at tomwoods.com/ebates. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to welcome back Eric Peters, who runs Eric Peters Autos, which you can check out at ericpetersautos.com or epautos.com. Tremendous site, does so much good work. And as I keep telling you over and over again, I'll probably mention it again. Probably mention it in a little while, that I donate to Eric Peters because I love what he's doing. He's the only guy doing it. He's a great guy. He deserves the support. So ericpetersautos.com is where you want to go. We've got a bunch of things to talk about relating to cars and liberty today. By the way, one quick thing about the audio today. Unfortunately, Eric's audio drops out a bit here and there. We lose a word here and there, and I apologize for that. We haven't been using Skype with Eric for a number of reasons, but we will use it next time, and that should solve this problem. But it is still eminently listenable. Eric, welcome back.
Good to be here. Always enjoy talking to a fellow libertarian heretic.
Oh, man, you have no idea. All right, listen, I got to tell you before we get started. Yesterday, or 2 days ago, we were in the car. This has nothing to do with you. I just feel like somebody's got to know this because it was just such an epic fail on my part. I got my Valentine 1 in the car, thanks to you. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I dawdled on getting it. By the way, you recommended it, and I dawdled on getting it. And then when I did get it, I knew I was getting a new car, and I thought, well, I'm not going to put it in until I get the new car. So it took me longer than it should have. But it's up and running, and I love that thing. Mm-hmm. So as I'm leaving our development, and I start driving, I see a police car taking its position, you know, in the median area to start, you know, pulling people over. And the Valentine one's going crazy. You know, of course, I can see by visual inspection, mm-hmm. there's a police car there. But nevertheless, the Valentine one's going crazy. And I actually said out loud, there's nobody could, you know, nobody else could hear. But I said, except my companion who was laughing, I said, nice try, copper. You know, not today. Not going to happen to me today. And not 2 seconds later, he turns around, starts following me. And I thought, but wait a minute, I'm not speeding.
Yeah.
There's no way you could be following me for anything. Mm-hmm. It turns out I had made a rolling stop on the way out of our development.
Oh,
okay, I hadn't come to a complete stop. I'd made a rolling stop. Now, of course, we all know if you have an IQ above 60, you can make a rolling stop without endangering anybody. There wasn't
right.
anybody within three states of me when I came out of that thing. So, all right.
But you technically violated a statute.
I get it. Fair enough. So, well, okay. So, secondly, I don't have my registration in the car. I have no idea where it is. Absolutely no idea where it is. So, there's another problem. So he goes back to the police car, takes an inordinate amount of time, comes back and says, all right, I got good news and bad news. Good news is I'm not going to write you up a ticket for the stop sign problem or the lack of a registration. Okay. But I am going to have to confiscate your license. What the heck? What? Apparently, I did get a ticket some time ago and they're claiming I never paid it. Now, I could have sworn. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, I got them dead to rights. And then I look through my records. I have no evidence that I paid it, and the bill isn't around. So I don't know if I put it in a briefcase and never mailed it or what the story is. But so we had to switch drivers. I had to sit in the back. I mean, it was horrible. So now I got to go to a courthouse. I got to use Uber to get to a courthouse. Then I got to get a whole new license.
Oh.
I mean, unbelievable. Now, it's not like, you know, I did the wrong thing, and I didn't, you know, I get it. And I'm not looking for sympathy, but I just thought, there's nobody else I can talk to about this and have an excuse for bringing this up on the show except Eric Peters. So there's my tale of woe about the car.
Well, you know, it's irritating because, you know, to me, it's an example of this kind of Pecksniffian busybodyism that now characterizes law enforcement and many other things besides. Clearly, you are not harming anybody or doing anything that should have been of any interest to a peace officer. And yet, you know, this guy wasted his time and your time. Well, perhaps not so much his time because he found out a way to extract revenue from you. Meanwhile, there are actual problems out there in the world, and this is what they're doing. And it just chafes. It rubs me the wrong way. These are, what do they call it in the law, not malum in se issues. That is, not things that are wrong in and of themselves, and we all understand you shouldn't steal things, you shouldn't hurt people, and so on. These are just foul things that they use as a means to hassle you and to extract money from you. And, you know, I don't think it's funny. It really rubs me the wrong way.
Well, I appreciate that. I agree completely. And I wasn't sure, I'm still not sure exactly how a lot of listeners would feel about the fact that I didn't actually have the car come to a literal stop, sit there, physically turn, all look all around, and then start the vehicle again. And that's true that I didn't do that. But I get that it's, you know, no matter who runs the roads, they'll have some kind of regulation about what you're supposed to do there, and fair enough. But honest to goodness, the fact of the matter is that there is no way anyone was in any danger by what I did. I mean, it's very flat, a very, very long stretch of road. You can see extremely far. There was nothing. Now, so unless some kind of new technology has come about of a car that can go 500 miles an hour and appear out of nowhere, nobody was in any danger. So,
unless they have a Klingon cloaking device. I have a stop sign that is up the road from my place, and I live out in the country, and I routinely roll through that stop sign for just the same reason. You can see literally a quarter mile in either direction. It is physically impossible that anybody is put into any peril, myself or any other person, by not coming to a complete stop like a robot just because there's a sign there. Ironically and interestingly to me, there's all this hullabaloo about how we're supposed to conserve energy and fuel. Well, it's incredibly wasteful to bring a vehicle to a complete stop needlessly and then accelerate. Your vehicle uses the preponderance of the fuel, accelerating all of that. So, you know, if people are really concerned about, you know, gas mileage, emissions, and pollution, they would say that the exercise of judgment in a case like that, and, you know, coming, slowing to look and then safely proceeding is not only sensible, but it's good for the environment and good for the economy.
Yeah, I guess the only thing it's not good for is their pockets.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's basically what it boils down to. All right. Let's talk about what's been going on at Eric Peters Autos lately. We've got some interesting libertarian stuff to talk about. But before we do that, let's talk about some of your new car reviews, because it's that time of year again, and you've been posting them on a regular basis for some weeks now. And I wonder if, because every year I think I've been asking you, so what, you know, what has stood out to you as you've tested them this year? Anything new for this year that particularly catches your fancy?
Well, I don't know if catches my fancy would be the right way to describe it, but there's a very, very interesting trend that's happening. And it is essentially the extinction of six-cylinder engines in mass-market cars, as well as diesel engines, obviously. You and I have talked about that before. But because of all the pressure coming from Washington about fuel economy, mid-sized cars, family cars, cars like the Honda Accord, for example, Mazda 6, no longer offer six-cylinder engines, even as an option, because those engines get slightly poorer fuel economy than the four-cylinder versions. So you're finding that these cars now are coming only with four-cylinder engines, and for the most part with turbocharged four-cylinder engines, which are more maintenance-intensive as the miles go by. And in addition to that, they are starting to put, if you can believe this, 10-speed transmissions behind some of these four-cylinder engines. The Accord in 2018 will come with a 10-speed automatic transmission. And again, they're doing that because of these incremental, slight improvements in gas mileage that they can manage that way, in order to meet the federal government's corporate average fuel economy mandates.
Wow. Okay, I didn't know that about that at all, because I've driven only six cylinders for years. I guess after, I'm so car illiterate, after I realized there's a difference and it matters, and even an idiot can feel it. And when I'm out on the highway, and especially when I'm merging onto the highway, I sure want that six cylinder.
Mm-hmm. And, they're trying to maintain the level of power and performance from the four-cylinder engines by going with a turbocharger. And the theory is that, when you need the power, you press on the gas and the turbocharger boosts the power of the engine. But when you're just driving along, the engine will get better gas mileage because it's a smaller engine, a four-cylinder versus a six. But in the real world, you find that these little engines have to work harder than the larger engine. And you wind up discovering that the gas mileage difference is negligible. I test drive these cars every week. I've been doing it for years, so I can tell you this from my own personal experience. The real world mileage difference is inconsequential. But down the road, if that turbo goes, and eventually it will, and the intercooler and the plumbing and all the other associated parts that go with it, the repair costs for that are forbidding, whereas a V6 doesn't have those additional components, so there's no chance that you'll have to pay for a turbo at 80, 90,000 miles down the road.
Wow, I did not expect you to answer this way. I had no idea that this was happening. Well, with that huge caveat then, are there particular cars nevertheless that you say, well, given these terrible trends, this one's not so bad?
Oh, yeah. The manufacturers are doing the work of Atlas supporting the world. They have to deal with all this rigmarole coming out of Washington, and yet they still manage to produce some pretty phenomenal vehicles, despite it all. To give you some specific examples of vehicles that I personally am a big fan of that I've recently driven, I had a Jaguar F-Pace, which is their new crossover SUV, and Jaguar is making an SUV now. And it is the only vehicle left in its class that still has a diesel engine option. And while mileage is probably not that big a concern to people who are buying $50,000 vehicles, what's really neat about it is the thing can go about 600 miles on a tank full of fuel. So you hardly ever have to stop. And that, to me, is a luxurious feature of the vehicle. Not to mention it's a good-looking vehicle on top of that.
Wow, that is great to be able to do that. Now, an SUV for a Jaguar SUV, it's not going to have an option for third row seating or anything like that, right? It's going to be just a five-seater?
Well, yeah, this particular one is a five-seater, but it actually can take five people, four plus the driver, whereas some of its rivals, in particular the Porsche Macan, which I like, that's a fun car, is effectively a four-seater. If you've ever been in that thing, the back seat has got a hump in between the two seats. And so realistically, you're not going to put three people back there. So that's one of the big advantages of that particular vehicle.
All right. What about a car that's, that costs a little bit less, is more realistic for a lot of people that you like?
Well, a friend of mine, I'm glad you asked that question, recently got the little Fiat 500 hatchback. And she got a tremendous deal on it because Fiat is having some difficulty selling those cars. Not because they're bad cars by any means. They just haven't done a very effective job of marketing them, as Americans in general are somewhat averse to very small cars. But it's a cute, fun little thing, and she picked it up for thousands of dollars underneath the MSRP sticker price. She couldn't be happier with it. It's fun. It gets great gas mileage. It's very space efficient on the inside, and you can park the thing almost anywhere that a skateboard will fit.
All right, so that's good. So what would you say then, if you had to say, all right, these are, I don't know what the typical sticker price for a mid-sized car is these days, so I'm not even sure where to start, but I don't know, somewhere, let's say 30,000 and below in that category, mm-hmm. Where should people look? If you had to name two or three.
Okay, I'll name one in particular. I'm a huge fan of the Mazda 6, and that is a mid-size sedan that competes with the blue chip models, being the Toyota Camry and the Honda Accord. The Mazda 6, even though it no longer offers a six-cylinder engine, as we talked about a few moments ago, is nonetheless one of the most enjoyable in its class. And in my opinion, it's one of the most good-looking cars in its class and otherwise. It's a striking-looking car. Mazda builds just beautiful-looking cars, and their ride and handling is exceptional. They manage to provide a balance of both handling and ride quality that usually you have to pick one or the other. The Camry, for example, is a great family car, but it's really squishy and soft. And if you're somebody who enjoys driving at a faster pace, it's probably not going to please you. The Honda Accord, on the other hand, is a fun and aggressive and sporty car, but it's a little rough riding, too. The Mazda 6 manages to give you both of those attributes in the same vehicle, along with really good gas mileage and just a really good vehicle overall, too.
All right. Well, those are great recommendations. Now, let's move on to some of your recent posts that you can elaborate on. One of them is called Little Brothers that I read, and it has to do with this trend now in the car where, I mean, in the old days, which was like a year ago, on your GPS, you might have a feature that it would show you, not always reliably, but, as up to date as it could be, what the speed limit of the road you were on was, which was a helpful feature, by the way, because it's not easy when you're driving to always be aware of that. So that feature would be built into the GPS. But now we're starting to see street signs and their contents being displayed in the car, and the car is aware of what the signs are telling you. So I actually have not seen that feature. So what's the potential problem here? I guess it's kind of obvious, but what's going on here?
Well, the technology is called traffic sign recognition. And as you described, essentially what it does, the car is aware through the GPS of your position in real time as you're driving. And it also is aware of the speed limit on the given stretch of road. And, you know, as you mentioned a moment ago, I'm not opposed to that information being displayed on the screen. Okay, I know what the speed limit is on this road. But the next step in the evolution is if the car starts to get angry and nag you, if you're driving faster than the speed limit, even if it's 1 mile over the speed limit, the little icon, which duplicates the physical sign, so you have an actual icon that looks like the speed limit sign, the white with the black numerals, goes red. You know, to hector you. Oh boy, you're speeding. And I'm certain that the next step is that the vehicle is going to actually intervene in the same way that vehicles now will already intervene to brake when the vehicle thinks it's time for you to brake, and will attempt to correct your steering for you as well. Superseding your inputs. I'm convinced that that's where things are going. That's been the trend with all of this technology over the past several years.
See, I like the idea that I like to think of the car as being sort of on my side. Like, it gives me information sometimes, but just to encourage me and to support me. I don't like the idea that the car is carrying out the agenda of some foreign force. I like to feel like my car and I have a kind of kinship here. I don't want to think my car is some kind of, you know, fifth column in my life, right? Don't want that.
I agree, exactly. That's my objection to all of this. You've heard of Cass Sunstein, right?
Oh, yeah.
He was one of Obama's advisors, and he came up with this concept of nudging people, you know, which nudge them with a bayonet, you know, force them to do what these technocrats, these people who believe that they know better than the rest of us how we should operate, ought to do. You know, not leave it up to us to make decisions for ourselves, but, to intervene and to direct us and to control us. That's the thing that I object to.
You have a piece called One Electric Car That Makes Sense. What is that car and what do you mean by that?
Well, it's the Chevy Volt. And what I mean by that is it's the only electric car that isn't functionally GIMPed. It actually works. It meets functional and economic criteria. And naturally, that's why it's not being promoted. Instead, they're promoting all of these electric cars that are functionally impaired and severely so, and that make absolutely no economic sense. The Volt is not tied to an electric umbilical cord. It has a very small gas engine that it carries around, but it differs from a hybrid. The gas engine in the Volt is there chiefly to serve as a backup generator to provide electricity for the electric drivetrain. You can drive that thing exclusively on electricity for about 50 miles. I've done it. I've test driven the vehicle. And then if you exceed that range, the gas engine will kick on and it will provide electricity to power the batteries and electric motors. So the thing works. It doesn't have any range limitations. You could drive it 400 miles if you want to. You don't have to sit there and wait for 30 to 45 minutes to recharge it to 80%. You know, that's not ever talked about. And that assumes a fast charger. I mean, it's bizarre to imagine that we're going to have a society in which hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of electric cars are going to have to pause every single day for 30 to 45 minutes and wait at a fast charger to recover 80% of their capacity to drive. Imagine going to McDonald's and waiting 30 to 45 minutes for a hamburger.
But the funny thing is, you don't hear that disability talked about a whole lot. All you hear is the wonders of green technology, but we don't hear about what you just said.
Yeah. It's, in my opinion, it is not merely incompetence, it's malfeasance. It's purposeful and deliberate. These issues are well known to journalists who are covering this issue, and yet nobody's asking the hard and legitimate questions about electric cars. I'm not anti-electric cars. but I am pro-truth. And I think that people have a right to be aware of these functional issues, which are significant. You can refuel a gas engine car in 5 minutes, and that is what our entire system is geared up to deal with. You know, you go to work, you leave work, you need to put some gas in the vehicle, you stop at the gas station, you put the fuel in, and 5 minutes you're back on the road. The idea that people are going to stop for 30 to 45 minutes, and again, that assumes one of these fast chargers, which are high voltage charging stations, which do not exist. An entire infrastructure will have to be built in order to have these fast chargers, such that hundreds of thousands or millions of electric cars could plug in. It's crazy.
Yeah, but then people could say, all right, maybe electric cars aren't so practical. That's why we have hybrids.
Well, okay, you can have hybrids, and hybrids, you know, they at least don't have the functional problem. But again, the economics don't make any sense, particularly now. As I'm sure you're well aware, the price of gasoline right now is at historic lows. If you adjust the current cost of unleaded regular for inflation and take out the taxes, it's probably cheaper now than it was in 1950. So what's the bum's rush for these hybrids and electric cars? Why? What's the reason for it? How does it benefit the average person? The hybrid costs several thousand dollars more, usually, than an otherwise equivalent car that isn't a hybrid. So why would you buy it? What is the point to buying this thing? You're not going to save money. Okay, you'll burn less gas, but you're going to pay more for the car. And unless you drive the thing for 400,000 miles, you're never going to reach the point at which that hybrid has saved you money versus the non-hybrid car, unless gas prices double.
But they would say that saving money is not the reason I buy one of these cars. It's because it has a smaller environmental footprint or something.
Well, they can say that, but to a great extent, that's a really ignorant statement. Most current IC engine cars, by the EPA's own terminology, qualify as, and this is their term, partial zero emissions vehicle. The emissions, the things that are actually harmful to people, that cause smog, that cause respiratory problems, are effectively nil at this point. We are talking about fractions of a percent that are coming out of the tailpipe that are problematic. Now, they can fall back on the, you know, the carbon dioxide thing and on the climate change thing, but CO2 is an inert gas. It has absolutely nothing to do with smog formation, with respiratory issues in human beings, with human health generally. So that's a whole separate thing, and you have to buy into the climate change thing, and that's another debate. It's irrelevant as far as in the way that emissions have been traditionally talked about and categorized.
Let's talk about your post called "The Kids Don't Wrench," talking about these days as opposed to, let's say, I don't know, maybe in the 50s or 60s or even 70s. You could see kids, as kids are curious about how things work, and that culminates in an interest in how cars work. And so people would get at least some kind of it wasn't that everybody was an expert, but people would gain naturally kind of a rudimentary understanding of the workings of the car that could come in handy from time to time.
Yep.
And that doesn't happen anymore. What's the reason for that?
Well, the reason just has to do with the orders of magnitude, greater complexity of any modern vehicle versus the vehicles that were built right up through the late 1980s, mid-late 1980s, is when things really started to get complicated. Prior to that, most cars, all cars really, were mechanical things, and they were approachable and accessible. You could physically handle, for example, a carburetor. You could pop the hood of a car, and it was this mechanical device, and you could rotate the throttle arm, and you could see the venturis, you could see the throttle blades, the choke. You could gain an understanding of it. A kid could understand that. It was very approachable, and that was the entirety of the fuel system, really, other than the fuel pump that fed fuel to the carburetor. So you could gain an understanding of it and then become familiar with its operation and learn how to service and work on it. Today, cars are largely computers. There's still machines underneath all of that, but they have a tremendous amount of computer stuff grafted on top of them, and you have to have almost some formal knowledge of electrical things and computer things to even begin to comprehend them, let alone service them. And then you need fairly expensive, specialized diagnostic tools to do it. Whereas in the past, a kid with a cheap screwdriver set and some cheap sockets that he picked up at Pep Boys for $20 could actually begin to work on a car.
You know, Eric, this is totally my fault. Let's go back to cars for a minute, because I want to actually give you a chance to talk about a classic car, because we were just talking about cars that the average person would be able to go get on the lot today. But mm-hmm. But you did a write-up about the Ferrari 365. This was back from the late 60s, early 70s. And what was it that you said about that? Because I know you love this car.
Well, boy, I could say many things about that car. It's one of my personal favorites. It's the last carbureted front engine V12 Ferrari that was ever made and imported to the United States. It's, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many other car nuts, the finest grand touring supercar ever made, both in terms of how it looks and how it drove. Just a magnificent car from any angle that you care to look at it. And I deeply regret sometimes that I wasn't born 30 years earlier so that I could have been reviewing cars like that when they were brand new.
Well, I'm going to link to, of course, to all the things we talked about, but I'm definitely going to link to your review of that or your write-up about it, because I think people will enjoy that and probably be somewhat envious while they're reading it. Let's go on to your piece called Tire Tyranny, because so let's start off with this. I go in to buy tires today. Something different is asked of me than would have been asked a couple of years ago. And what is that and why?
Well, you know, they actually don't even ask anymore. They
just go out and do
it. Called the VIN, the Vehicle Identification Number, which for those of your listeners who aren't familiar with it, if you look at the corner of the dashboard near the windshield in the upper part of the dash, you will see essentially a barcode, just like the barcode on the things that you buy at the grocery store. And it serves the same purpose. It carries all of the information about your particular vehicle, when it was made, which engine it came with, which transmission it came with, all of the options it has, and so on and so on. And it's typically these big chain shops right now will scan that VIN and then restrict you from buying tires that you might wish to buy, which they will claim were not original equipment or don't meet some specification. Like the speed ratings. For example, if your car originally came with a tire that had a V speed rating, and on my site I've got a little chart that shows what these specific ratings are. The V rating is for safe travel at speeds up to 149 miles an hour. Now, the key word there being sustained. You have to drive at sustained speeds that fast or more before it becomes an issue. Well, some people might elect to buy a tire with an H rating, which is up to 130 miles an hour sustained travel, because it's less expensive. And generally, the tire with the lesser speed rating is going to be a bit softer riding, so you have a more comfortable ride, and longer lasting because the compound is less super aggressive than the V-rated tire. There's no harm to come from this unless you actually are going to drive in excess of 130 miles an hour for sustained periods of time. But, you know, the tire Nazis, as I style them, will not sell you that tire.
Good grief. Mm-hmm. Now, this is just being done of their own accord. This isn't any regulation that's in place, right?
No, it's no mandate. But all of a sudden, I've had it by some of my readers. And apparently, it's become quite the thing with the big chain retailers that sell tires. The smaller, the mom and pop stores, you know, are more agreeable and won't do that. And by the way, these VINs, this data that they're collecting, they actually tap into the state DMV. So they're tapping into the government database. They get your license plate number and your VIN, and they can access all of the information about when your vehicle was last inspected, what service was done to it, whether it's passed smog. I don't know for a fact, but I presume that they probably also have access to your DMV driving record. And again, these are private corporations.
Well, in situations like this, it's kind of hard to, or at least it's more of a challenge to answer people who say, look, you libertarians are only concerned about the state, but corporations are pretty crummy too. So how do you deal with that as a libertarian?
Well, they make a point. You know, unfortunately, and I weep for this, a lot of corporations have essentially decided if you can't beat them, join them. And they are adopting some of the same coercive methods that the government has used and which we decry. I'll give you a very good example. The last time the car industry actually attempted to fight the government over a mandate was back in the 90s over airbags. They sent engineers to talk to the regulators and pointed out to them, look, these things are potentially dangerous. They're going to hurt elderly people. They're going to hurt children. It's a fact. Here's why. They explained all of this to the government and passed the mandate regardless. And they decided after fight, they were just going to go along with it, and if anything, anticipate it. And now they've become even more aggressive in some ways than the government with regard to pushing some of these things onto people and claiming it's for safety. But in fact, it helps them make more money, you know, because they can add a feature to a car, and if it's a mandate, you have to buy it. And down the road, if it's a mandated safety equipment, well, you have to service it if the component fails or breaks or something happens to it. And that has become the new business model, unfortunately, for a lot of corporate America.
Your website is ericpetersautos.com, and people can get there via the shortcut epautos.com. And in addition to new car reviews, you have primarily libertarian car content, talking about precisely the sorts of issues we've been talking about today. So those of you interested in cars, this is the site for you, epautos.com. And even if you're not interested in cars, in fact, I cannot tell you how many times, Eric, I've had people say, you know, I used to skip the episodes about cars because I thought I'm not that interested in cars. But then I listened to one and I realized, well, I am interested in Eric Peters because, man, he really makes it come alive. He makes me interested in these things. Now I realize why I ought to be. So that's really great feedback. And you, I think, are unique. I don't think there's anybody producing the kind of content you're producing. So you are one of the people I make a monthly contribution to. So I would urge people to consider emulating my practice by heading over to epautos.com, checking it out, and making a contribution to Eric. I make a contribution that goes to him every month, and I'm extremely glad to do it. And he also has a free ebook when you sign up at his site. You could sign up for it. It's right at the top. This is for free. You don't have to donate to get it, although donating is nice. I urge you to do it. But his free ebook is on buying a car and how to do so without losing unnecessary money. It's very, very valuable to get that. And it's more than typical so-called free ebook is like 400 pages in, you know, 68-point font. And you know, this is a real book, and it's really helpful to you. So you can sign up for that at epautos.com. And then while you're there, kick in a few bucks for Eric. He's doing excellent and important work. Eric, we'll look forward to another conversation in the future. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. And I'm sorry about your ticket.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You bet. Always had a good time.
All right, everybody. We are getting closer to the rescheduled 1,000th episode event. So when that 1,000th episode is added to the list of episodes, you may, in your player, have to scroll down to find the 1,000th episode. You're not going to Don't tell me you're not going to listen to the 1,000th episode after everything we've gone through to get this thing up there. You are going to listen to that thing. Okay, if I have to come over there and click on it for you, you're going to listen to that thing. But I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle because it'll be, you know, 15 episodes down in your player by the time it comes out, because I'm going to try and put it in there right where it should have gone if we hadn't had to reschedule it because of the hurricane. But anyway, this coming Saturday, September 30th in Orlando is the 1,000th episode event, and you can register for that at tomwoods.com/Orlando. Costs you nothing, but there you go. So make sure and do that, because it would be great to have you. We're going to have a lot of fun doing that. All right, that's it for today. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.